Hare Krishna. Dola. Hare Krishna. Dola. Yeah, chant. Hare Krishna. Just trying to get you to open your mouth. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Okay, so this morning we'll talk a little bit about another bogus mantra, Nitai Gaur Adishayam, Japa Hare Krishna Hare Ram, which Prabhupada references quite a bit in his books also, in his purports, and in conversations he would always cite that as being a prime example of an unbona fide chanting or mantra to chant. So May the 2nd, 1976, Srila Prabhupada was on his last day in Fiji. We'd gone there for about a week. He did the foundation stone ceremony. He initiated a couple of the local devotees there, Vasudev Prabhu and Bhumohan, his brother. And of course Fiji was a little isolated. In those days they had no TV reception either, so it was kind of a nice place. It was very quiet, not many visitors, so we had an opportunity sometimes to sit in Prabhupada's room with him and just have, you know, private discussions. So this particular day Guru Kripa Maharaj was there. He was the local GBC at that time. And so we got in a conversation about chanting and about gurus from other sampradayas, etc. So Prabhupada's feelings about Mayavadis are well known, but there are variations of Vaishnavism that are not so clearly understood. Desiring to get some clarification on gurus who may not be so far removed from our lineage, Guru Kripa Maharaj cited the statement in Shastra that if someone can induce others to chant Hare Krishna, they must be empowered and therefore qualified. So he asked about one Charandas Babaji, this is Radharaman Charandas Babaji, in Bengal, who in the early part of this century had induced people to chant a mantra which included the holy name. He had built up a large following, but the mantra was his own invention and not strictly within the parampara. Prabhupada acknowledged that the man had some credit, but he said that overall he was not successful because of his deviation. He introduced a new system of chanting, Nitai Gaur Radishayam. So the Nitai Gaur chanting will have some effect in Kali Yuga. Although he was presenting pervertedly, the beginning was Nitai Gaur, so it would have some effect. He did not know, actually, Nitai Gaur. From his words, it appears. He used to preach that Nitai is Radharani and Gaura is Krishna. So that is Siddhanta Virudha. But somewhere in another, he was chanting Nitai Gaur, and so some effect was there. Just like sandalwood, you do not know which way better to make the pulp come out, but if you rub it anyway, some pulp will come because it's sandalwood. So he had some effect of chanting Nitai Gaur, but they later on deteriorated because they did not know actually, and neither they were taught. Siddhanta Virodha means it will deteriorate, it will not endure. Guru Kripa then brought the conversation closer to home. He wanted to know about Srila Prabhupada's godbrothers, because they have disciples, they are properly initiated, and they give the Hare Krishna mantra. Prabhupada gave us a frank, unbiased analysis from his own broad perspective and successful experience. The thing is, the spirit, the real service of preaching, that has stopped. The formality is going on, but the real business is not. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement means Amara Gaya Guru Anatare Aidesh. Become a guru and try to liberate everybody in this land. So that has stopped. Do you follow? The formality is there, but the real life of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement is preaching. Otherwise, why Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, Amara Agyaya Guru Hanatare Desh. Tara means preaching. Yarideka Tara Kaha Krishna Upadesh. You instruct everybody to follow the instructions or orders of Lord Krishna as they are given in the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam. So that has stopped. And they are satisfied if they could construct one temple and beg some rice from the neighborhood. Sir, we've got some temple. So that's all. They are satisfied. But the spirit of preaching forward, Papi Tapi Jata Chila Harinama Udarila, that the holy name delivers those who are lowly and wretched, so that is stopped. So by Harinam, by chanting in this way, to live a little peacefully in the temple and eat and sleep, that much they have got. If that is success, then that success they have got. So this was condemned by my Guru Maharaj, to earn some money by showing a deity in the temple and eat and sleep, better you become a sweeper in the street and earn your honest livelihood and live that way. Many temples in Vrindavan, he said, have the same mentality. They think that they think of the operation of the temple as a business. That if people are coming and they give something, oh, that is their good income. So according to the temple's popularity, Prabhupada told us, they think, oh, this is our success. Therefore, they are deteriorating. So that is not success. Success is his who is pushing forward the preaching method. That is his success. And if we think that by showing a deity in the temple, we get some money and rice and cloth and just peacefully live here and don't bother going to Fiji and all over, so that much success they have got. But that is not Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Prithivi Chaitanya Nagaradi Gram Savatra Prachar. So what are they doing for that? That is the point. So Guru Kripa wanted to know, what if sometimes a disciple, he may go to preach, but he's not preaching in the exact same spirit as his spiritual master. So he's getting gradually closer to home. He started talking first of all about other Vaishnavas, but not bona fide. Then he asked about Prabhupada's godbrothers, and now he's asking about certain disciples of Prabhupada, you know, that had their own ideas. So what about if he wants to go preach, but he's not preaching in the same spirit as his spiritual master, because he's referring to Siddhasarup's group at that time. Therefore, he is not to preach, Prabhupada said. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, Jamasartaka Karikara Para Upakar, go and do good to others. First of all, you do good to yourself. So first of all, you become really preacher. Then you go to preach. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu never sent a neophyte to go and preach. For the neophyte, preaching is not their business. For the neophyte, one should stick to the worship of the temple deity. And those who have understood the philosophy and applied the philosophy in his life, then he should go for preaching. Otherwise, he'll preach wrongly, like this Charandas Babaji. And then it will stop. He wanted to preach, but he did not know how to preach, and therefore after his life it is finished. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu does not say like that, that you remain a rascal and go and preach. No. Jambasaratakakari. Your first business is that you make your life perfect, then you go to preach. So perfect means that you learn how to obey my orders. That is perfection. Amara Agyaya. So if you're actually perfectly carrying out the orders of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then you are preaching. Otherwise, you'll do wrongly and mislead. So don't do that. Anna yatanandaya upaniyamana. If you remain blind, then don't try to lead other blind men. That is misleading. First of all, open your eyes. So everything is there. Nobody can do anything whimsically. If you do whimsically, concoctedly, then that will be a failure and it will not be effective. So Prabhupada was very clear, yeah, about, you know, where other people stood. The criteria, of course, is to measure up against Lord Chaitanya's actual instructions. And you see, actually, who's an associate of Lord Chaitanya, who's a bona fide preacher, by how well they're fulfilling the instructions of the Lord. So just by making some claim, that's not enough. So this Radharamantaran Das Babaji, he didn't even know the philosophy, but he became very popular. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati at that time was living in Puri when this man was becoming popular, and he was preaching very strongly against him. So all these Babajis, they became very anti, you know, against Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, and especially later on when he formed the Gaudiya Mat. And then, you know, he wasn't just one man, then he expanded into many. And, you know, they were very vigorously preaching. So the Babajis were very much against them in various ways. So this, just a little footnote on Radharamantaran Das Babaji, another aspect. Not only did he not know the philosophy, but he was a full-on Sahajiya. So this was on January the 24th, 1977. Prabhupada was in Bhubaneswar, and he was discussing about Ramakrishna, another bogus so-called Paramahamsa, and he described him as a Sahajiya. And he also mentioned Radharamantaran Das Babaji, who introduced the chanting of Nitai Gaur Radhishyam Japa Hari Krishna Hari Ram. He also posed himself as being one of the gopis with his sakis, or friends. And he used to advertise that he was having his menstrual periods. So these rascals, they all dress up as women, and just to get into the mood of the gopis, no, I can't see you now, I'm having my period. Nonsense. But this is Ramakrishna, this is Radharamantaran, and a lot of these Babajis, this is their, you know, bogus practice. So, and then one little kind of meeting that we had with a few people that were chanting this mantra. February the 6th, 1977, we'd left Bhubaneswar, we came back up to Calcutta. Prabhupada had been invited to come to Panihati, which nowadays is almost, it's been kind of consumed by Calcutta. It's kind of merged in with it almost. It's about an hour north if you drive from the center of Calcutta. And there was some talk at that time. There was a group that had some land. The original house of Raghava Pandit was still there. There were some other important places. Of course, Panihati was the Chiradayi festival, that site there. So the banyan tree that's described there in that Leela, that's still there on the banks of the Ganges. So there was some offer at that time that some men there, they wanted to give some land to ISKCON and see us develop the place. So Prabhupada had gone there before we went to Bhubaneswar, and then again when we came back, he visited it again. And he was very interested. He really wanted to get something there because he said it will be a very important place. Also, it was on the banks of the Ganges. So Prabhupada commented that we could have boats going from here all the way to Mayapur and back again. He said we can use it as a highway. He said it is much safer than the other highway. So like that, then February the 6th, we went back to Panihati, and we saw the site of the Chiradayi Mahotsav Leela, where the banyan tree is, and Prabhupada had them measure out the land, and also some adjoining land on the riverbank, which he said that we could also apply for. He said it could become an important center, and thousands would come because it is approachable by the river. He liked the idea of travel from here to Mayapur by the river, and said we could purchase large river launches and use the Ganges as a highway to travel there, because this highway is much safer than the other highway. As he looked at the land, a kirtan party of older men came with garlands to greet Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada ignored them because they were singing Nitai Gaur Radhishyam Japa Hari Krishna Hari Ram over and over again. This happens to be the site of a small temple which has a murti of Radharamantaran Das Babaji, who was the originator of this chant. Prabhupada accepted their garlands, but otherwise he ignored them. He was distinctly not pleased, but he didn't want to be impolite, so he allowed them to put garlands on him, but he wouldn't engage with them at all. He just walked off. It was very uncomfortable with their bogus chanting. Okay, so a little bit more about Nittai Gaur. The other night we heard that Prabhupada said, you know, of course, chanting Nittai Gaur is always beneficial. But actually the Acharyas chanted all five names of the Panchatattva. And therefore, technically, any deviation from what the Acharyas were chanting, even if it's bona fide names, it becomes Guru Ravagya, which is one of the, you know, 10 offenses in the chanting. However, something else that Prabhupada said, we were in America, in Washington, in early July of 76. Prabhupada had gone there because the devotees had purchased a new property, which we still have, Potomac. And also it was the 200th anniversary of American independence, July 4. So they were having, you know, a huge celebration there. And the devotees thought it would be a good idea to have Prabhupada come into the capital, you know, on their so-called Independence Day. Actually, in Mayapur in March, Rabindra Swarup Prabhu had come and interviewed Prabhupada for an article to be put into Back to Godhead for that particular month of July. So he gave a wonderful article about how we're not actually independent. Then that Back to Godhead magazine came out just before we arrived in Washington. And on the front it said, declaring our dependence on God. So instead of declaring our independence, it said declaring our dependence on God. Prabhupada liked that very much. And that was the first time that Back to Godhead was printed 1 million copies for the month. So in those days, you know, Back to Godhead was a huge magazine. 1 million copies. Anyway, so we were there in Washington, just next to Washington, just, you know, down the road practically, about 40 miles, there's Baltimore. So we also had a small center in Baltimore. And some beautiful Gaur-Nittai deities. They're still there. The same house is still there. I was there a couple of years ago. And Rupa Nuga had shown Srila Prabhupada a picture of Gaur-Nittai. So he was so attracted to them, he said, why don't we go there? So instead of going for his morning walk, we went by car to Baltimore. So Prabhupada didn't speak much on the way. This was on July 7, preferring to chant quietly on his beads. Several other cars of devotees also accompanied our vehicle along the way. Actually, some of the members of the newly formed Bhaktivedanta Institute, they were meeting with Prabhupada in Washington, so they also came out to Baltimore as well. The temple is a large two-story suburban house with some land at the side and back. The main room on the ground floor has been converted into a temple. The altar was profusely decorated with a dozen vases of colorful flowers, and everything was clean and bright. Prabhupada stood for several minutes in front of the gorgeously dressed forms of Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda, visually drinking in the beauty of their visage. The deities bore the most beautiful of smiles, appearing effulgent and well cared for. Then Prabhupada mounted his Vyasasan to receive Guru Puja and then give his class, which was on the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhyalila, chapter 20, 102. So he started speaking on the Chaitanya Charitamrita because after Washington we were going up to New York, and then they were going to have the very first New York Rathayatra. So as a build-up for that, the devotees thought it would be nice if Prabhupada started speaking from Chaitanya Charitamrita. So he did. So Pradyumna Prabhu led the devotees in responsive chanting of the verse. When we finished, Prabhupada smiled. It is, of course, a Bengali text, and Srila Prabhupada is from Bengal. He chuckled, telling us that technically, our chanting was all right, but we should learn how to chant it as the Bengalis do. Anybody here from Bengal? No. Anyway, the Bengalis have a very sweet way of, you know, pronouncing. So Prabhupada, I guess to Srila Prabhupada, our attempts to chant the Bengali verses was kind of grating on his ear a bit, but he wanted to encourage us. But he did politely mention that we should learn how to chant it properly. So the verse concerns Sanatan Goswami's questioning of the Lord as to why he had to suffer the threefold miseries of life. In his half-hour discourse, Prabhupada explained that suffering was alleviated when one regained his original spiritual position. He also expressed his satisfaction with the devotee's service. So, this benediction, he said, is offered by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who has very kindly come here, Nitai Gaur. So you take advantage of his mercy. You were very fortunate that Nitai Gaur is here. If you simply chant Nitai Gaur and dance, then you'll be happy. There's no difficulty. You were chanting Jai Sachinandan. So this simple chanting, Jai Sachinandan, Hare Krishna, I am not manufacturing. It is the injunction of the Shastra. So in this age, simply by chanting and dancing, you'll get complete spiritual service. So I'm very glad that you're taking care of Gaur Nitai Gaur so nicely. They are so nicely dressed. So continue these activities, and even if you can't do anything, simply chant Hare Krishna and Jai Sachinandan and dance. That will make your life perfect. So chanting Nitai Gaur, of course, is, you know, as Prabhupada said, always beneficial, even in that bogus mantra, because it begins with Gaur Nitai or Nitai Gaur, therefore there's some effect. So what to speak about if you chant it properly. And of course, if you have the deities of Nitai Gaur installed, then you can chant the names of the deities, no problem. That is not Guru Ravagya. That is approved. So Prabhupada clarified a bit there. Okay, so the topic on this section has been, you know, unbonafide chanting, bogus chanting. And Prabhupada, you know, would sometimes warn the devotees. We already heard about how he stopped the chanting of Bhaja Hare Krishna, etc. So on November the 5th, 1976, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, and he was giving a class from the 5th canto, chapter 5, teachings of Lord Rishabhdev. So this was on sloka number 14. So Prabhupada's conclusion was that if we practice according to the prescribed method, Shastra Vidhi, then we can become liberated. Otherwise, he said, it's not possible. Quoting both Lord Krishna and Rupa Goswami, who both advised that we not act whimsically, but only according to the scriptures, he condemned concocted forms of spiritual practice. In that connection, he also had a few words to say about the fashion of making up one's own mantras. There are so many they have invented, he said. Just like the Hare Krishna mantra is prescribed in the Shastras, and they have invented so many. Although there is the name of the Supreme Lord, still you have to follow the Shastra. If you say Ram, 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 Radhe, 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 Krishna, so there are so many mentioned. That is also a name, but you have to follow the Shastra. And Shastra says, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. You have to take that. Not that you can say Nitai Gaur Radhe Shyam, Hare Krishna, Hare Ram. No. Why? Is there anything in the Shastra? No, you have invented. So what is the value of your invention? You are not perfect. But they say like that, oh, it is my guru, I have got some followers, I invent some kind of chanting. This is nonsense. You must follow Mahajano Jena Gita Sapanta. You cannot invent. Very strong, very clear. No Radhi Radhi Radhis, Ram Ram Rams. You chant the mantras according to what's given in the Shastra. You can't make things up. It becomes a habit, and of course this is Kali Yuga, and people like to make things up. Why? Because they're not satisfied with what they've been given, and they want to get some distinction as a big chanter of the holy names. So I'm leading Kirtan, I want to be distinguished from another Kirtan leader. Oh, I have done something different. I've done something a little special. So they add this, they change that, stick in a word here, you know, like that. So this is bogus. Prabhupada never approved of that. You just chant the standard mantras as they're given in the Shastra, then you won't go wrong. Otherwise, of course, maybe somebody may make up a mantra that's okay, but maybe not. If they're not qualified, just like I think it's coming up actually, but this, what is it? Raghupati Raghava Rajaram Patita Pavana Sitaram. So that's a nice verse, but actually it's a part of a bigger song, most of which is about politics, because it was written, it was actually written by a follower of Gandhi under his inspiration. So that little verse was okay, because it's just the names of Sita and Ram. But the rest of the song is, you know, useless, because it's actually just, you know, meant for some political purpose, that's all. So maybe by accident somebody actually writes something that's okay, but if they're not actually, you know, advanced devotees, then invariably they'll write something that is not okay, and it'll all be mixed in, and then people will be misled. We'll see some examples of that in a minute. So making up one's own verses then is not welcome. So January the 25th, 1976, Prabhupada was in Mayapur, and he was out on his morning walk. So as we walked around, Anantaram Shastri joined us. So Anantaram Shastri was one of four Shastris that had joined our movement the year or 2 years before. He was an educated man, and you know, he was fluent in Sanskrit, as his name implied. He was a Shastri, so he knew Sanskrit very well. He was a young man, about our age, about 25 years old at that time. And the other three Shastris had left, and he was the last one remaining. So Prabhupada instructed Bhavananda Maharaj to make sure that he is well looked after, so that he may not go away. Although a somewhat self-conscious individual, Shastriji was eager to recite a poem that he had composed for Srila Prabhupada's pleasure. As we walked, and without asking first, he suddenly broke out into melodious verse. He just suddenly started singing at the top of his voice as we were walking along, singing the praises of Bhagavan Sri Gopal, or at least it seemed so. His chanting was impressive to my untrained ear, but Srila Prabhupada was alert. When Shastri sang, "Nachiye, Nachiye, Aile Gopal," "My dear Gopal, please come to me dancing," Prabhupada immediately stopped him. "Do not manufacture knowledge," he said. "You take knowledge from Bhagavan. Do not order Bhagavan. You just follow Bhagavan. That is not wanted. Do not write concocted poetries. That is not beneficial. You simply follow." Prabhupada told him that his singing was sense gratification, because he was giving instructions to Gopal, "Please come to me, Nachiye, dancing." He stressed that our process is to take instruction. "It is all nonsense," he said. "Why you should ask Gopal to come to you? You cannot order. You must follow. We are to carry out the order of God, not to make God carry out my order. That is a mistake." So he immediately picked it up. Prabhupada was listening very carefully. First, you know, hint of anything wrong, he stopped him. Prabhupada went on for some time, condemning the attitude with which people generally approach God. He explained that in India they sing a traditional arati song, which repeats the words, "Sabko Sampati De Bhagavan." Some of our Indian devotees will recognize that line, "Sabko Sampati De Bhagavan." De Bhagavan means "give me." And in the West, he explained, the Christians also have the same idea. The whole world, Prabhupada observed, they have accepted God as their order supplier. I order, you supply. Christian church also, "God, give us our daily bread." And if God doesn't give, then God is dead, Tamal Krishna added. Dead, yes. So this is going on. And our prayer is, "I don't want anything. Simply engage me in your service. That is the real prayer which has been taught by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So Shastri actually, he was invited by Prabhupada to travel from Mayapur to Vrindavan with him, and he thought that he'd been added to Prabhupada's party as his Sanskrit man. But then when we left Vrindavan, he didn't take him with him. And then when we came back to Vrindavan in September, after a few months, he was gone. But in the meantime, he did do one good thing. He wrote some nice verses glorifying Srila Prabhupada, which we may have time to get to either this session or tonight's session. So, another person who Prabhupada pulled up for making up his own verses, this was a devotee called Pandu Das. He was an artist. He still lives in Mayapur, but he goes under the name of Gadadhar Pran nowadays. Another bogus individual who actually left, gave up Prabhupada and took reinitiation from some Babaji. So at this time, of course, he was living in Mayapur. He was quite a good artist. And when we arrived on January the 17th in 76, we actually got down on the front road and the gates were closed, the front gate, because they just completed the gatehouse and they wanted Prabhupada to officially open it. So they had a big ribbon and a pair of scissors and everybody gathered around and Prabhupada cut the ribbon and then they opened the gates and we walked in. So that front wall, you know, with the main gate on either side, there was a very high wall, and on the inside there were rooms attached to the wall. On the outside, then just blank space, so they'd sculpted like some kind of simple panels. Yeah. And so Prabhupada had taken a morning walk and he had instructed them now in each of these panels, paint pictures of my books. Yeah. And then it will be an advertisement. Of course now you can't even see the wall anymore because there's so many bogus illegal shops that have been erected all along, you know, our boundary. You can't even see the wall anymore. But if you actually look behind the shops, you'll see there's still the remnants of some of those paintings. So that was at Gopurnima in 76. So August the 19th, 1976, in Hyderabad, Jaipataka Maharaj and Gagamuni Swami had flown over for the opening of the temple and for celebrating Prabhupada's Vyasa Puja. So then the next day, there was some report that they were giving to Prabhupada about Mayapur. So last March, Prabhupada had asked that the large panels sculpted in cement along the front wall be painted with advertisements for his books. He was satisfied to hear that two artists, Anakadundabi and Pandu Prabhus, had completed about 17 of the panels. So then we came back to Mayapur on, I think, about February the 8th. And then the next morning, in 1977, then on February the 9th, Prabhupada took his walk and he went out onto Bhaktisiddhanta Road and he inspected some new paintings that had been done on the large panels on the wall by a Western devotee, Pandu Das. Prabhupada didn't say much and I got the impression that he wasn't exactly overjoyed by what he saw, but he wasn't dissatisfied either. Then he saw a Bengali verse which was written on the wall. And he stopped and he asked, "Where does this verse come from?" So it was written in Bengali script. Pandu admitted that he had made up the verse himself in English and then had it translated into Bengali and then he painted it on the wall. Such a rascal. Yeah? So daring. Yeah, made his own verse up and painted it right there on the wall. Prabhupada was not at all happy. And he shook his head and admonished him quite strongly not to do it again. "Do not dare like this," he said. "You should always remember, do not manufacture ideas." So Pandu asked, "Well, should we change this one?" So he was still, even though Prabhupada was chastising him, he was still hoping that it was okay and he could leave it. That was his mentality. So Prabhupada told him, "No, it is all right. But do not dare like that." And Pandu nodded yes. So As soon as Prabhupada left the planet, a very short time later, he left ISKCON, took reinitiation from some Babaji, and basically joined up with the Gauranga Nagari Sampradaya. Yeah, another bogus Appa Sampradaya. He still lives down the road, and he sells paintings to unsuspecting ISKCON devotees because they have a lot of money. And otherwise he goes on with his bogus practices. So anyway, that was the symptom right there. Yeah, that he was not satisfied with what he was getting from Srila Prabhupada. He was looking for something else. He had his own idea. He's making up his own verse, thinking that he can write something, you know, better than... I mean, there's how many verses in the Chaitanya Charitamrita he could have chosen? You know, they were painting pictures... he was painting, you know, each of the volumes of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, because they have a different painting on the front cover. So they were painting a picture of the book cover. He could have picked any verse from each one of those books and put that on the wall. No, he has to make up his own verse, and so daring, putting it on the wall there for the public to read. And Prabhupada, of course, caught him out immediately. So that's a few examples of, you know, making things up. There was another devotee, I haven't actually got this written down, and I just realized I should have included this. But there was another devotee in Mayapur at that time. What was his name? Hiranyagarbha. And he was the headmaster of the Gurukul at that time. So he had come to see Srila Prabhupada, I think in February 77. Prabhupada was taking his massage up on the roof, and Hiranyagarbha came up, and he had attempted to transform the verses of the English verses of the Bhagavad Gita into rhyme. So he'd written a whole bunch of verses, and he came and he read them out to Srila Prabhupada to see if they were okay. And Prabhupada liked them, he approved them, and he said they could be printed in the Back to Godhead. But then he gave him a whole 10-minute lecture about how you should be very careful just to follow the guru and not jump over. And I at the time, I couldn't kind of quite figure out why Prabhupada said that. You know, of course, anything Prabhupada said was fine. But specifically why he chose to warn him not to jump over, you know, the previous acharyas. You know, I didn't quite fit it in, because at that time Hiranyagarbha was, you know, one of the leaders in Mayapur. He'd come to Srila Prabhupada with his poems, you know, to get approval. So it seemed all right. But again, after 1 or 2 years after Prabhupada's disappearance, he was another rascal that went off, took reinitiation from some Babaji. For some time he became a professional Bhagavatam speaker, earning some money in India that way. And then he ended up going back to the West and becoming, you know, some so-called professor. So that tendency was there in him also. And Prabhupada, you know, picked up on it. And he warned him, don't jump over your guru. But that's exactly what he ended up doing. So, okay, so chanting Sanskrit. The sound is important. This is another interesting little incident. Which had more significance many years later. Before we left India, or just before we left India, Prabhupada had been sent a questionnaire from Bhavan's journal. Bhavan's journal, I don't know what it is. Is it still going, Mahatma? Bhavan's journal, is it still going in India? Anyway, it was like a spiritual periodical that was being published in India. And they had noted the phenomena of Indian gurus going to the West and becoming very popular. You know, it kind of really took off from the 1960s onwards. Now, then there was a controversy in India whether this was going to water down the tradition, you know, the culture, Vedic culture, blah, blah, blah. The smartas were up in arms. You know, Prabhupada himself had been criticized for giving initiation to Westerners, etc., etc. And so many other gurus, you know, were going there and, you know, basically making up their own processes, the TMers and Muktananda was there and so many others, and that bogus little fat guy that was claiming to be Krishna, Guru Maharaji, right? Remember Guru Maharaji? Yeah. So that, you know, there were some gurus that were becoming popular, and there was some concern amongst the traditionalists in India whether that was actually going a good thing or a bad thing, and whether they were actually promoting Vedic culture or whether they were, or Hindu culture, not Vedic culture, or whether they were spoiling it. So they drafted up a list of about 22 questions, which they sent out to all these different spiritual leaders, and then they were printing one by one each month the replies. So it was sent to Srila Prabhupada. Pushyakrishna Swami was Prabhupada's secretary, so he decided to take up the task of presenting the questions to Srila Prabhupada, recording the answers, and then transcribing them, and then he was going to send them to the Bhavan's journal. So on July 1st then, we were in 1976, we were in New Vrindavan. So Prabhupada remained in his room, and he finished the questions and answers from the Bhavan's journal. So he'd already done a couple of sessions, so now we were beginning with question 10, which was the first of the session, and it caught my attention. The question was, will mantras lose their sanctity or holiness if they are not in the Sanskrit language? So that was a big issue, Sanskrit, you know. Only if you know Sanskrit can you actually read the Shastra. That was always one of the refrains from the Smarta Brahmins. If you don't know Sanskrit, that's it, you're disqualified, you cannot read Shastra. Of course, Prabhupada was translating everything into English, so that was a point of, you know, contention for some. So the question was, will the mantras lose their sanctity if they are not in the Sanskrit language? Prabhupada explained that they are transcendental sounds and they cannot be changed. The sound must be vibrated, he said. You cannot translate it. The sound as it is, just like the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, so the sound must be produced. You cannot translate. Then it will be artavada, or speculative interpretation. So that is prohibited. You cannot interpret or do in another way. The sound vibration must be there. Then it will continue in sanctity. Pushyakrishna asked for clarification. Is that to say that the mantras can be written in the Devanagari script or in Roman script, but the sound must be the same? Yes, Prabhupada said, the sound is important. So it's interesting that he spoke that in New Vrindavan, because a few years later, of course, the leader of New Vrindavan decided to become ecumenical. Yeah, he decided that, you know, wearing Indian robes, you know, dhotis, kurtas, saris, you know, this was putting people off. People in America couldn't relate to it. Sanskrit names, Sanskrit songs, nobody could understand them. So we should, you know, as they say, anglicize them or westernize them. So then he adopted a pseudo-Baptist approach, because he was from a Baptist background originally. He, you know, had his preachers dress in Christian monks' robes. And they started to Americanize everything, or the whole program. So they rewrote all the different mantras in English. And then they put them to verse, and they would sing them. So instead of, you know, coming to Mangalarati, they were still coming to Mangalarati and worshipping the deities. But instead of singing, you know, Samsara Dava Nalalida Loka, they started singing an English version of it. Some English verses, and they had a guy with an accordion, and, you know, they would all sing the English, and they stopped singing the Sanskrit. Yeah. And there are many other things that they did, you know, just changing things around. And of course, even he went so far when he was giving initiations, he wouldn't even give them Sanskrit names anymore. You know, somebody came up, "Oh, you are Purity Das." Sanctuary Das, you know. And even I heard one time somebody brought their kid, you know, to get a name, and he called it Halava Das. Needless to say, as Prabhupada pointed out with the Radha Ramancharan group, it cannot last for long. You know, it was a bogus extrapolation or innovation, whatever you want to call it, deviation. And of course, by 1994, when I went to visit New Vrindavan, they were just on the verge of coming back into ISKCON at that time. That leader had been exposed and he was kicked out. And then just the last remnants of his particular following were still there. And I had gone there in 1994 on a book tour. And just I thought, I'll go there just to encourage, you know, the ISKCON devotee, loyal devotees that were still there that were now trying to bring the program back to the original that Prabhupada had given us. So it was kind of bizarre. I went there and there was still this one guy there that was a real diehard follower of his guru. So he was still insisting on singing all the English, you know, arati songs. So they were having like a dual arati. We sang the samsara prayers in the Sanskrit, and then this guy pops up with his accordion at the end, and then he sings everything again in English. And then they did the same thing for Guru Puja, and it was really bizarre. But not long after that, you know, then they swung back over to the complete Sanskrit program again. So it's just, I thought it was ironical that in 1976, in New Vrindavan, Prabhupada had made that comment that mantras must sound the same. You cannot change them or translate them. They have to sound the same. Okay, so some other corrections in Kirtan. This was Ram Nomi, 1976, April the 9th. Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. It was the first anniversary of the opening of the Krishna Balaram Mandir. And at midday arati, some devotees were singing over the microphone a mantra glorifying Sitaram. Raghupati Raghava Rajaram Patita Pavana Sitaram. So this was on Ram Nomi. So they were also chanting some of the mantras. Prabhupada sent me into the temple with a message that they stop. He wanted them to simply chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, because he said it automatically includes Lord Ram. He said that other mantras were not necessary. So Prabhupada did not like that trend, you know, on special appearance days of chanting over and over again other mantras. Prabhupada was, you know, this was the Hare Krishna movement. Prabhupada was all about promoting the Hare Krishna mantra. That is the bona fide mantra for this age. It is the Maha mantra, so it includes every other mantra. And he wanted the devotees to be well aware of the fact that if you just chant Hare Krishna, you are not missing anything. There's no need to bring in anything else from anywhere else. Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is complete and there's no need for anything else. So that was one correction. Another correction that just a footnote on that. I mentioned this, but I had heard that this mantra actually, you know, was a made-up mantra. It was not from a bona fide, you know, sampradayic source. And I heard, you know, that Gandhi himself had made it up. So I wrote in 2005, I wrote to the Bombay Sarvodaya Mandal Gandhi Book Center. And one gentleman there, Mr. T.R.K. Samaya, he replied my question as to what the origin of this mantra actually was. So he wrote back to me, he said, you know, because I'd heard that Mahatma Gandhi wrote this, is that a fact? So he wrote back, he said, this was on September 26, 2005, somebody else wrote this with the suggestions of Mahatma Gandhi. So it's not, you know, from any Sampradaya, it was actually from one of Gandhi's followers. So, by chance, that particular verse was okay. But the rest of the song, Prabhupada said, was written for political purposes, so it was useless. In that respect, then, there was a letter. Because Prabhupada himself had introduced that little verse to the devotees. And for a short period of time, you know, he allowed it to be chanted, and then he changed his mind. So in 1969, 13th of February, Prabhupada wrote to Krishnadas, who was one of his first GBCs. He said, regarding the Raghupati Raghava song, we are not concerned with this song because it had a political motive. It is not pure devotional service. Gandhi was a great statesman in the garb of a saintly person, so that the Indian population would blindly follow him. But this motive was political, and therefore we are not very interested with it. However, you can sing the first two lines, Raghupati Raghava Rajaram Patita Pavana Sitaram. So he gave some approval. It's not wrong to sing it. But at the same time, as I experienced 7 years later in Vrindavan, Prabhupada didn't like it being sung in the aratis. So he told them to stop. You just chant the Hare Krishna mantra. So that's mantras. Another correction that I was personally on the receiving end of was in 1975 in September. Prabhupada had come for his first visit to Krishna Balaram Mandir since the temple opening. It was opened at Ram Navami, then he went off on tour. Then he came back for 3 weeks in August, September to celebrate Janmashtami and Radhashtami. And of course, he wanted to see how the temple was going on. So at that time, I was the temple commander. And Prabhupada had given strict instructions that, because there was no regular Sankirtan activity going on as there were in all the Western temples. The Krishna Balaram Mandir was the first custom-built temple in ISKCON. And in India, you know, the activity there was not book distribution so much. It was barely started at that time, but, you know, life membership making. But the majority of devotees that were in the Krishna Balaram Mandir, you know, we were just doing temple services, cleaning, cooking, looking after the bookstall, blah, blah, blah. So Prabhupada told us then, you must have 3 aratis a day and everybody must attend. Mangal arati, midday arati, and evening arati. Because he wanted, you know, to attract the local people. He wanted to convince them, you know, about the Hare Krishna movement, what he was doing. And so he wanted to have a good program of solid aratis throughout the day. So at midday, I was chanting in the temple. So I was leading the kirtan, singing over the microphone. And I was also chanting the refrain over the microphone. Prabhupada sent Upendra out to tell me to stop chanting the refrain. He said only the lead should be broadcast on the speakers, but not the refrain. So that's another thing that we have to put up with in India. It's become a popular thing that, you know, they chant the lead and the refrain over the microphone, and it just bombards you. Because it's the holy name, that's all right. But the fact is that when you chant the mantra, when you chant the refrain over the microphone, one person chants it, and the microphone, the speakers dominate everything. So then all the other people that are supposed to be doing the refrain feel discouraged from singing the refrain because it's coming out over the speakers from one person. As soon as you stop doing that, you'll see everybody starts chanting louder. Yeah, when it's not amplified. So anyway, just a small point. One thing, you know, that I was personally instructed by Prabhupada not to do. Okay, another deviation that Prabhupada noted in chanting was organized by Jayapataka Swami. Those of you who are disciples, don't get upset. I'll explain why in a minute. But this was in Mayapur. 1977 on March the 5th. So Jayapataka Maharaj, in order to popularize the Gopurnima festival at ISKCON in Mayapur, because our reputation was just growing slowly at that point, but it was becoming a focal point, you know, for Gopurnima to come to the ISKCON temple. So Jayapataka Maharaj, in the spirit of, you know, advertising and promoting ISKCON, he advertised that there was going to be a kirtan competition at ISKCON Mayapur in Gopurnima. And all different kirtan groups were invited to come from all over Bengal. And also, you know, there would be the different yatras from, you know, America and Europe and Australia, whatever. Then they would also form groups and compete in this kirtan competition. And every night they would have, you know, two or three different groups come up and do their thing. So it seemed to be going on quite well, you know. It was certainly livening up everything because there was constant kirtan going on. So on March the 5th then, there was a kirtan competition which seems to be going on very well. Different groups from around Bengal have been invited, and groups of our devotees representing different yatras from around the world are also competing. The best group was to be awarded some prize. So each evening, several different groups have been on stage doing their chanting. In the evening, Prabhupada was coming out from his room to go down the veranda to his bathroom. So he stopped for a moment to hear one of the Bengali groups that was singing. And then he asked me, "What do you think of that?" So I wasn't sure what to say. You know, if Prabhupada asked you a question like that, it was kind of like a loaded question. You knew that Prabhupada had his own opinion. And so you were reluctant in case, you know, if you replied and said the wrong thing. So I wasn't sure what to say. I was reluctant to reply just in case I got it wrong. So a moment later, Prabhupada asked me if I wanted to know what he thought of it. So I said, "Oh yes, Srila Prabhupada." So then Prabhupada replied with a smile, "I think they are doing it simply for money. Such chanting is worthless." And then he walked off to the bathroom. That was all he said. He didn't tell me, you know, go and tell Jayapataka Maharaj to stop it or anything, but he just made that passing comment, "I think it is worthless. They are simply chanting for money." So I did in fact immediately, you know, inform, because I didn't want Srila Prabhupada's words to go in vain, as they say. So I immediately informed Jayapataka Maharaj, "Prabhupada thinks your kirtan competition is bogus." So he came up to see Srila Prabhupada, and Prabhupada explained. He said, you know, later on he condemned it. He said that the groups that were coming were doing it simply to get some name and fame. So, you know, that was obviously that they, whoever, if they won, then they would be able to tour Bengal and say, you know, "We won the ISKCON kirtan competition." Then they'd charge people money for coming to hear them, etc., etc. So the whole thing was just a business arrangement. So that was it. Jayapataka Swami, when he heard got the word, decided never to hold it again. And of course, we have not done that. And we don't need to do such things anyway, because, you know, ISKCON is now swamped with people on Gopur where you can't even move anymore on the campus. So we don't have to advertise for people to come. And people come anyway because of the kirtan that's always going on. And that's really the difference between ISKCON and many of the other mats there, that Prabhupada arranged it in such a way that there's always kirtan going on 24 hours. And big, big RTs, you know, lots of chanting. And that's why people come. You go to any of the other temples, there's one or two, you know, brahmacharis chanting. And then at the end of the RT, nothing. So there's nothing to attract you. In our ISKCON temple, you know, evening RTs, there's like 50 or 100 brahmacharis and devotees all chanting. And it goes on, you know, for an hour or so. And they really get fired up, they get into it. So all visitors come, they know this is the place, you know, this is where all the action is. So that, you know, it's Prabhupada's genius. Okay, so another thing about chanting mantras for selfish purposes. This was a discussion on a morning walk in Bombay in 1975. Prabhupada was there for about a week or two. And on December 23rd, we were out on Juhu Beach, because Prabhupada liked Juhu because there was this wonderful beach just 5 minutes from our temple. He could take his morning walk there. He could go a long, long way. It was very nice and flat. So every morning he was going out. And this particular morning we had a discussion, a long discussion, about the relationship between Lord Vishnu and Lord Shiva. At one point, the famous battle between Banasura and Krishna was mentioned, where the ultimate weapons of Lord Shiva and Lord Vishnu were pitched against each other. The Shiva-jvara produced intense heat, but the Vishnu-jvara, which generated intense cold, was the victor. So at that point, an Indian devotee said that when Prabhupada was very ill in Vrindavan, this was the year before, he had fallen extremely ill, he got a very high fever and almost left his body. This, he was in Vrindavan with Shruti Kirti Prabhu. This was like mid-1974. So he said, and the word was sent out actually to all the temples to do 24-hour kirtan. And we did that for about a week. And then, you know, Prabhupada recovered. So this Indian devotee said that when Prabhupada was very ill in Vrindavan with a high fever, he had prayed that the Vishnu Jvara might reduce his fever. So he said, so we were just reading the Bhagavatam when you were sick. So anybody suffering from fever means you read such and such a portion and then it will come down. So Prabhupada immediately, it seemed like a nice sentiment, but from Prabhupada's pure devotional viewpoint, it was not acceptable. No, he said, Vishnu should not be utilized for curing your fever. That is not bhakti, that is business. Prabhupada was very sharp. I mean, he, you know, really was very clear about what the philosophy was. So Kirtananda Swami asked, can a disciple invoke Lord Vishnu's help for serving his spiritual master? So Prabhupada replied more enthusiastically. He also revealed something of his internal mood in his struggle to establish the Bombay temple. He said, yes, that is nice. That is for curing Vishnu's representative. When we were in danger and there was so much obstruction for constructing the temple, we prayed to Krishna that it should be stopped. So we prayed to Krishna, please give your protection. So that is for Vishnu's purpose. So you can pray for specific things in devotional service as long as it's for Krishna's purpose. You know, to achieve some preaching goal for the pleasure of the Lord. But if it's just for some personal reason, that's not acceptable. Okay. Another example of chanting, you know, for material purposes that again Prabhupada had to correct. This was in Mayapur in 1977 on February the 25th. Rameshwara Swami had arrived from America. He was the BBT trustee and he was also in charge of, you know, the production of the Back to Godhead magazine. So it had become quite controversial. I had lunch with Deb and Rita Maharaj 2 days ago, and we were discussing this. He had arrived just after this particular meeting. He was working for the BBT, and it was a big controversy in the BBT at that time. It was, you know, the direction that they were going with the Back to Godhead. Again, there was that tendency that, you know, the clothes, the tilak, the names, everything was too foreign for the Americans to be able to, you know, get attracted to. It was, you know, maybe actually a detriment. So he had gotten permission from Srila Prabhupada that when they printed the name of any author of any article in the Back to Godhead, they could put his legal name rather than his Sanskrit name, just so that American people could relate to it more easily. And they were reducing the amount of Sanskrit that was being quoted there. You know, in different ways they were trying to relate Krishna consciousness to, you know, kind of mode of goodness, you know, things, simple living, high thinking. There was an article about farming, organic farming, and the whole article didn't mention Krishna once, but it was there in the Back to Godhead. So it became very controversial amongst a lot of the devotees, you know, that we had joined. I mean, I remember when I joined, I bought my first Back to Godhead in Sydney in May of 1971. I just arrived there about, I think, 1 or 2 days after Srila Prabhupada had left Sydney after his first visit. So we bumped, you know, I came as a £10 pom. £10 immigrant. We got off the boat, we went into the city, and we bumped into the devotees. So I brought it back to Godhead, and it was number 37. It had the Rasalila on the front. So I kept the magazine, we took it back. We were, I think, staying in a hostel in Marrickville. We got 2 weeks free in a hostel, and you had to find a place to live, get yourself a job, and then you were on your own. So there was, I came over with three friends. We met a bunch of guys on the boat from London and Scotland. And so there's like a whole group of us, about 12 of us, when we went into the city, and then we bumped into the devotees. I was the only one that was interested. You know, they were chanting, and I just thought, wow, what's this? By Bobby Cheru's wife from Utah, she was selling back to Godheads, and, you know, she came up to me and, oh, what's that? So I gave her 20 cents, and I got it back to Godhead. And she invited me, you know, you come to our, we have a Sunday feast. And I was thinking, Sunday feast? What is a Sunday feast? You know, and I couldn't think, what is a feast? Right? And the only thing that I could think of was, you know, some of these, like Robin Hood or, you know, some of these medieval films and dramas where they have these big feasts in the castle, you know, and they've got a big bench and the hunting dogs are down on the floor and, you know, they've got the hog's head and, you know, the, right? I was thinking that was the only thing I got. What is a Sunday feast? So anyway, you know, the whole thing was completely foreign. You know, seeing the devotees dressed like that, I'd never come across them before. I was attracted, but I couldn't figure out what the heck it was. So when we got back to the hostel, you know, I pulled the magazine out. Everybody wanted to see what it was. And we looked at it. We looked at the front page. We couldn't make head nor tail of what was going on. You know, all these little blue men, you know, dancing in a circle, and there was what seemed to be, you know, some people in a bunch of flowers, you know, floating in the air, you know, above them, the demigods, right? And we couldn't figure it out. And then the closest we got was this Scottish guy that we'd met on the boat, Bill. He looked at it and said, oh, he said, I think those blue fellas, I think they be spirits. Right, so he'd heard that spirits were blue, right? So that was, you know, all the, you know, expansions of Krishna there, dancing with the gopis. So then we looked inside. There was a line drawing of Narada Muni, and I thought, who's this woman? Right? Lotus eyes and, you know, beautiful features. And there was some Sanskrit written underneath, and I couldn't even focus on it. I couldn't make head nor tail of it. So I just thought, you know, I'm not ready for this yet. But the magazine itself was alive. I could feel it. There was a vibration about it that was so unusual. I thought, I have to keep this magazine. I'll keep it now. Later on, when I'm ready for it, then I'll read it. I actually was thinking like that. And later on, I did read it, and it started making sense. But, you know, it was straight Krishna consciousness, you know, full on, you know, Sanskrit preaching, you know, Prabhupada's articles, whatever. So we all had that experience that even if we didn't actually understand everything that was in there, somehow or another, because it was pure, it was spiritual, it was Krishna, it was none different from Krishna, and we knew there was something special about it. So now, you know, by 76, there was this move towards making it more identifiable by the American public or the English-speaking public. So they started, you know, cutting down on the Sanskrit. They started, you know, putting in these articles that were not directly about Krishna, but some aspects, you know, organic farming or whatever. So it became a big controversy. And there were a lot of devotees that were not really happy with it. But, you know, the editors at that time were convinced that this was okay. They had gotten permission from Srila Prabhupada, you know, to change the names and stuff like that. So anyway, it came to a head in Mayapur. And there was a big discussion about the whole editorial policy in the BTG. And then one specific point came up which I was particularly interested in, and it concerned the mantra page in the beginning. So the mantra page was a single page with it shows small pictures of people who are not full-time devotees, but who chant with, who chant, and it had a comment from them underneath. It's meant to convey that anybody can chant without having a shaved head and robes. Yeah. So there was some little comment. Yeah, when I get up first thing in the morning, I chant, you know, Hare Krishna mantra. It makes me feel good for the rest of the day. I can go out and, you know, do my business with enthusiasm or something like that. Yeah. So Prabhupada pointed out that getting people to chant is all right, but they must understand that there is a process for chanting. He said they must come to the initiation point regardless of whether they're in a temple or not. So that way then, this is the point. It's not just chanting, but you must come to the point of initiation. Chanting seriously, not casually, but actually making a commitment to the chanting. Then it's all right. So I asked whether it was an offense to advertise that material benefits come from chanting, and Prabhupada confirmed it is aparad. He elucidated this point that they must understand that chanting means there is a process and they have to come to that point and then it will be effective. Otherwise, he said, if they do not come to this point, there is a chance that they will become degraded instead of elevated because of their increased offenses. The process means one has to follow the regulative principles. And he stressed this again and again, that they have to know what is the proper process in order to get success. Very interesting comment, that if you chant without following the process, right, the standards, purifying yourself, then instead of becoming more advanced, you'll eventually become more degraded because you're using Krishna for material purposes. Then that commits more offense. So in the, you know, introductory stage, when you don't know anything, namabhasa, yeah, you don't know actually the philosophy, but you hear the chanting, so you just chant it. You may chant it casually or whatever. You'll get benefit. But if you continue to do that, and you don't gradually get purified to the point where you actually follow the process, eventually that chanting will degrade you. Okay, so that's the end of the section on unauthorized chanting. The next section is a little bit on authorized ways to sing new songs and mantras, which we will do in the final session tonight. Right? We have a session tonight? Yes. So we'll do that this evening. Any quick questions or comments? Yes, Prabhu. Yes, several years ago there was some discussion about the chanting of Radhe Radhe. It's become another one of those ISKCON fads over the last 10 years or 15 years. Now people, instead of saying Hare Krishna, they say Jai Radhe, Radhe Radhe. Yeah. And it's become like a novelty thing. Or, you know, somehow or another, I don't know what the mentality is. Maybe they think that it's, you know, even a higher platform. Instead of saying Hare Krishna, you say Radhe Radhe. I don't know what the novelty is there, but people do that. And sometimes, you know, we've seen in the last few years, you know, groups of devotees at Rathyatras or in the temple, and they get completely into this Radhe Radhe business, you know, chanting it for long periods. So that's also become controversial. The GBC has set up a Kirtan Standards Committee several years ago. I happen to be a member of that. And we are looking at that. Last year we had some recommendations passed regarding instrumentation, which we may get to in this seminar, what instruments to play and when to play them, etc. That was kind of like a preliminary step forward for the Kirtan Standards Committee. And this year we are discussing about the chanting of mantras, what can be chanted, when it should be chanted, etc. So that issue is coming up. That was actually, it was such a hot issue at one point, that was actually what precipitated the formation of the Kirtan Standards Committee. So we're kind of working on it. Unfortunately, we're probably one of the most inefficient committees on the GBC. So we don't get very much done. But we're working on it. It's coming. Who's on the committee? Lokanath Maharaj, Vyasaki Prabhu, Jagajivan Prabhu, Aniruddha Prabhu, myself, Gunagrahi Maharaj, and I'm sure I've left somebody out now. Who? Oh, Jananda Maharaj, yes. So that's our main group. So let's see. We'll come. There are definite things that Prabhupada said. I already mentioned that one quote there before. Do not invent. Radhi, radhi, radhi. That's not approved, actually, by Srila Prabhupada. When Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, any time that he was out walking, you know, people would come past. And invariably, because in Vrindavan, they do say, Jai Radhe. Which Prabhupada, you know, as mentioned, you know, complimented that the residents of Vrindavan, they all know that you can't come to Krishna except by Radharani's blessings. And so they, you know, often say, Jai Radhe. But when Prabhupada was greeted with Jai Radhe, he would always reply, Hare Krishna. I never heard him say Jai Radhe once. He always said Hare Krishna. And the reason why is because it's the Hare Krishna movement. It's not the Rowdy Rowdy movement. You know, it's the Hare Krishna movement. Hare Krishna mantra is the Yuga Dharma, chanting that particular mantra. And therefore, Prabhupada's mission was to introduce that and focus on that. So, you know, it's nothing wrong with saying the name of Radharani, that's for sure. But that is not the purpose of this movement. And Radharani is Hare anyway. As he said, the Maha Mantra includes everybody. So you only have to chant the Maha Mantra. There's no particular advantage, you know, from going somewhere else or chanting some of the mantra. Okay. Another question. Yes. Yes. Yeah, when you're out, you know, on festivals, Rathyatras, street kirtan, the rules are a little different, you know, than chanting in the temple itself. In order to attract people, you know, then you can adopt different methods. You can use, you know, more instrumentation. Whereas like in the temple room, Prabhupada was very clear, mridanga, kartals, gongs, and, you know, the wampus, that's it. He didn't like any other instruments, definitely not harmonium, for kirtans and aratis. For bhajans, he said it's okay, but not for anything else. You know, so in the temple it's a little different, but when you're out, you know, advertising, so to speak, then you can use different methodologies. Prabhupada allowed other instruments to be played, or, you know, a little variety in the singing. Yeah, it's not, as long as they're bona fide mantras, but don't make anything up. That's, yeah. Somebody else, yes. Singing Jagat Guru or Gurudev. Prabhupada again said he was specifically asked about Gurudev. He said it is impersonal. He said you should not sing Jai Guru, Gurudev. He said, because we used to do that during his Guru Puja. But Prabhupada said this is impersonal. He said the Guru is a person. So he said if you want to sing Jai Prabhupada, that's fine. Yeah, so sometimes, you know, we sing a combination of Jai Gurudev and Jai Prabhupada, indicating Prabhupada. But to sing just Jai Gurudev is not recommended. Because Gurudev, you said that, who is that Gurudev? Could be anybody. Yeah. Yes, Mataji. Sorry, say it louder. Oh.
And I'm wondering whether did you go and what were your impressions?
Oh, okay. A bit of an autobiography question here. Did I go to the Sunday feast? And if so, what was my impression? No, I didn't go. I did remember about it. The Sunday, it was a couple of days afterwards. It was Sunday, and I thought, you know, these people said there was some Sunday feast, so I should go. But then, you know, we'd just arrived in Sydney. I hadn't got a clue where the temple was. I had no idea where I was. So, you know, I would have had to get a taxi to get there. At that point, you know, I just met the devotees. I had no idea what it was really all about, although I was attracted. So I didn't go. And I remember it was raining that day as well, so that was another put off. So it took me about 6 or 7 months before I actually visited a temple, because we were in Sydney. We actually didn't like the place. You know, I was from a small village actually in England. And Sydney was just too much. It was just overwhelming. And on the way over, we had stopped off in Perth for a half a day. The boat stopped there. And we liked Perth because it was small, very open. And so we decided, after our free 2 weeks, you know, in the hostel, we decided to head back to Perth. So we did that. We went by bus. Last time I'll ever do that one. It was difficult. It was a long, long trip, just sitting day and night, you know, in the bus seats. It was really painful. And then from there, after a couple of weeks, we went up to the north because we couldn't get jobs in Perth, and we went north. And we spent 6 months on a mining camp at Parabadoo. Anybody been to Parabadoo? It's not very far from Mount Tom Price. Anybody been to Mount Tom Price? No. They're mining camps, little townships. At that time, Parabadoo was just under construction. So we spent 6 months there. But, you know, I was going through a lot of personal changes. And I had my back to Godhead. The first time I really tried to read it was when we arrived in Perth. So about 2 weeks after buying it, we got to Perth. We were renting, you know, some bedsit, and we couldn't get jobs, so we had nothing to do. We used to spend our time playing cards and gambling and other things, which we won't mention in front of the deities. You know, sometimes I get bored with playing cards, so I pulled out this Back to Godhead, and I read the first article, which was, you know, Srila Prabhupada's lecture. And I got really excited. One, because Prabhupada was using analogies. And I had gotten so obtuse in my thinking at that point, because I was a real speculator. I got so obtuse in my thinking that I got to a point where I couldn't actually properly express the thoughts that were coming in my brain. You know, sometimes I would subject my friends to 6 or 8 hours of non-stop, you know, verbal diarrhea, basically. I got to a point I couldn't actually, whatever it was I was feeling, I couldn't express it properly. And I read Prabhupada's article, and the first thing that I read was this example of the glass, you know, which is filled with ink. And if you empty out the ink, then that's not sufficient. You have to fill it with milk. Otherwise, if it remains in an inky atmosphere, then it will again fill with ink. And so Prabhupada used that as an example that it's one thing to, you know, rid yourself of material thoughts. But if you don't replace those with spiritual thoughts, then in the material world, you'll again fill up with material thoughts. So you have to, you know, change your consciousness, basically. So when I read that analogy, I was so happy. You know, I was so impressed with what Prabhupada was saying, because he explained concepts in such a clear way. And then at one point in the article, there was something along the lines that, you know, you don't have to do yoga. And what had happened, actually, I mean, if you really want me to bore you, but when we had left England, I was going through a lot of changes. I had had this out-of-body experience, And it suddenly, it was like waking up, or beginning to wake up. I suddenly realized that it was another level of reality that I had no idea about. So I wanted to find out. And I'd met a couple of friends. We'd gone down to London for various purposes, again, which we won't mention here. We met this guy who was from my hometown, and he was practicing Hatha Yoga. And he had been heavily into drugs at one point, but then he stopped and he took up yoga. When I met him, I was really impressed with him. He was bright, he was energetic, you know, completely cheerful. And he told me, he said, drugs are not the way. He said, if you want to really expand your consciousness, that was the key thing in those days, expand your consciousness. So if you really want to expand your consciousness, take up yoga, you know, because it's natural. And that made complete sense to me, that if you're doing something artificial to expand your consciousness, you're dependent on that artificial aid. And when it's not available, you know, then how you will do it. But if you do it naturally, then, you know, that means it's permanent. So I liked that. I had no idea what yoga was. I actually literally couldn't tell you at that time what the difference between yoga and yogurt was. I thought it must be all the same stuff, you know. So, because I was brought up in this little iron and steel town, you know, in northern England. So yoga, you know, yogurt, what is that, you know. Anyway, somehow or another, it stuck with me, yoga, become a yogi. And I figured out that Jesus Christ that was one of my early revelations, that Jesus Christ must have been a yogi, because he was walking on water and, you know, doing so many things. So I didn't want to become a follower of Jesus. One of my friends did, but I didn't. I just was interested in the fact that he was a yogi. So when we were on the way out from England, we went by boat. So we had to take a train to London. We had a couple of hours there. And then we had a connection to Southampton, and then we got on the boat. So in London, we were walking around. We wandered into a newsagent's store, and there was a yoga magazine. And I got really excited. Wow, there's a whole magazine about yoga. And I'd never seen one before. So I bought it straight away. I thought, you know, I'll read this on the boat. So I did. But I was really tremendously disappointed, because, you know, the whole thing was about exercises, you know, Hatha Yoga, and you sit like this and you move like that, and, you know. And there was, what I was more interested in was the philosophical part of it. And there was one article that was purportedly about, you know, how to meditate. So I was really attracted to that. And I actually, when I saw the thing, you know, most of it was about doing these exercises, I remember telling one of my friends that, you know, if you have to do it like this, this is going to take lifetimes. I didn't know what I was supposed to be achieving by it. I knew it was something higher, but I knew this is going to take lifetimes if you're just doing it by physical exercise. But I was attracted to the, you know, so-called philosophy that was there. And there was an article about meditation. And I read it, and the whole thing was about how you put an apple on the corner of the table, and you sit down and you stare at the apple, right? And, you know, when your mind becomes still, then you're meditating. So I thought, you know, I'm not going to sit down and stare at an apple all day, you know. So I was really disappointed. I was I felt a little bit cheated, frankly. And then, you know, we arrive in Sydney. I buy the Back to Godhead. And as soon as I read it, you know, there was stuff in it that I couldn't understand, which was really attractive, because that meant I could learn more. And so to get back to the point, when I started reading it in Perth and I read Prabhupada's article, he said, you know, you don't have to do yoga. This is yoga. Chant the Hare Krishna mantra. And when I read that, I thought, wow, yeah, this is it. This is so simple. I could do that, you know. And I remember my friends were playing cards. I ran in. I said, just see, look what it says here. You know, you just have to chant this mantra, and that's yoga. And I really wanted to be a yogi. So Prabhupada, you know, gave me the way to do it. So that was it. You know, I got hooked into the Back to Godhead. And then I would take it out every month or so, and I'd read another article whilst we were working up in the north. Finally, I got to a point, and I did actually start trying to chant a little bit whilst I was, you know, up working on the work site. And but I really didn't know how to do it properly. So I just got to a point by Christmas of 71, I just got to a point where I couldn't tolerate, you know, what I was doing anymore. I would go out on the work site and it was like looking at a TV screen. I just couldn't relate to what was going on around me anymore. I was becoming so detached from it all. And at the same time, I was a little nervous because I really didn't, I knew, you know, I was kind of moving away from material life, but I didn't know anything about spiritual life, and I was in this kind of limbo. And it was a bit scary, you know, not knowing where I was anymore. I couldn't identify with everything that I'd ever known, and I had nothing to transfer that to. So it was, you know. So I just thought, this is it. I've got to go back to Sydney. I have to find these people and, you know, get some answers to my questions. So I left my friends up there, and I traveled down in early January to find the devotees in Sydney. And on the way through, we stopped actually, I stopped here in Melbourne, and I had like an 8-hour transit. And so in between when I'd seen the devotees in Sydney and then when I came back to Melbourne, the devotees had actually opened a center here in Melbourne. I think they had some small place in Carlton or something. I can't remember the address now. Anyway, so, you know, I was at Flinders Street Railway Station. I had booked a ticket to Sydney for that evening. I thought, I'll have a look around. So I walked down Swanson Street, and you know, I hear this, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. And there were the devotees. They were chanting in the city square. So immediately, I'm, wow. They were the people I, you know, I'd come to see. So I went over, and what's his name? Upananda. He was a brahmachari. So he had a big stack of magazines he was selling, and there were quite a few people standing around. So I went straight up to Upananda, and I saw he had more issues of Back to Godhead, and I'd read mine. So I immediately, you know, he had three more issues, so I immediately purchased the three. And then I asked him, I said, have you got anything there that tells you what God is? Stupid question, of course, but for me, that was it. That was my last question. I thought I'd figured everything out. The whole material world was worthless. It was just an illusion. You know, it were, you know, we reincarnated. We, you know, existed beyond time. I kind of figured it all out, but I couldn't figure out what God was. And it was bugging me like anything. That question would keep coming back into my mind again and again. What is God? What is God? That little three-letter word, you know. And I really didn't have any answers. And actually, on the way down from the northwest, I'd stopped off in Perth for a few days, you know, to stay with a friend. And one guy on the work site, he was in kind of into impersonalism, and he had read this book, First and Last Freedom, by Krishnamurti, and he was raving about it. Oh, I read this far out book, it's really great, you know, it tells you you can be your own guru, you don't, you know. He said the most far out thing is that he tells you that when you've read this book, throw it away because you don't need it. So he thought that was really something, you know. Right? So he told me, you get this book. So I thought, all right, when I get to Perth, I'll buy it. So I did. And I went straight to the table of contents. And I saw, there was, I think, maybe the third chapter or something. It's a long time since I saw that. But it said, is there a God? So I thought, wow, you know, let me see what he says. So I turned straight to that chapter. I didn't read anything else. And he starts off, he says, well, a lot of people, you know, they ask me, does God exist? Is there a God? So I tell them that if you believe there's a God, then there's a God. And if you don't believe there's a God, then there is no God. And I just thought, this is so bogus. You know? Even I knew, you know, if God exists, it's got nothing to do with whether I believe it or not. You know, either he exists or he doesn't. So I just threw that. I took his advice. I threw the book away. And so I was kind of, you know, disappointed. But then I got to Melbourne a few days later and I met Upananda and I asked him, you've got anything there that tells you what God is? For some reason or another, although I'd read the whole Back to Godhead, numbers 37, that little bit didn't click. There's so many other things that were making sense, but that little bit didn't click, that Krishna is God. So Upananda, to his credit, he had read the magazines that he was selling. So he opened it up straight away, one of the mags, and he read this one paragraph from Prabhupada's article, and it was a description of God. And he said, God is omniscient, God is omnipresent, God is omnipotent, and God is a person, and his name is Krishna. So I put my finger in so I wouldn't lose the page. I paid him some money. Upananda was doing his very best to persuade me to come to the temple in Melbourne. He got really excited because he found somebody that was actually, you know, looking for what he was giving. But I had it in my mind that I had to go to Sydney. That was where I first met the devotees. So it was just like locked in my brain. Sydney, 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 right? So I took the magazines and I had a couple of hours. I went down and sat on the banks of the Yarra, you know, to wait for my train. And I, you know, took the magazine out and started reading it. So I went straight to that paragraph. And when I started reading it, the whole thing just, that was it. It was like my epiphany, my moment of realization. Because I had, you know, gotten this kind of mental image sometimes that I would, that I was outside the universe looking in. And it was an enclosed space. And all the living beings were running around, and all their running around was completely meaningless. Like ants, you know, if you put an ant's nest in a box, glass box, you can look and see them running around, but what does it mean? So I had this kind of vision of the universe, that it was like that. And I was outside of it, and therefore beyond time. But the problem was I couldn't see where I was. And I couldn't look behind me to see where, you know, what was behind me. I could only look in, but, you know. So when I read this description, Prabhupada said, you know, God is omniscient. And it immediately, you know, kind of like a light bulb went off in my head, that what that meant, that he knew everything that was going on in the universe all at once. I understood it. And then God is omnipresent. He's everywhere. Again, another light bulb went off that he's everywhere. That, you know, if you're above the universe, you can actually be everywhere at once in the universe. And then he's omnipotent. He's all powerful. Again, another light bulb went off that he's, you know, if you're outside looking in, you can control the whole show. And then Prabhupada said, and God is a person. When I read that, it was like about 1,000 light bulbs went off. And I thought, that's it. Finally, I got the answer. And for months, this thing had been bugging me. What is God? What is God? And total blank. And then finally, Prabhupada said, and God is a person. And I thought, of course he has to be. If you know everything and you're everywhere and you're controlling everything, you have to be a person. But that was it. That was my, you know, revelation on the banks of the Yarra. and then Prabhupada said, and God, and his name is Krishna. And I thought, wow, he's actually got a name. So that was it. And then the implication hit me immediately. It was instantaneous with that realization, was that, you know, I've spent so much time in like about a year or so looking, trying to find answers. What's going on? Why we're here? You know, what's beyond death and all this stuff. And now, you know, I finally found out that everything is under God's control. Every living being, he knows everything that I'm thinking. He knows there's nowhere I can go where he doesn't know that I'm there. and he's completely in control of everything. So I thought, well, if I accept that this is true, I'm going to have to surrender. I actually thought that, you know, that I'm going to have to surrender and serve him. So that was kind of scary, because the implication of that was now you have to give up everything you've ever known. All your friendships, all your, you know, whatever things you were working, you give it all up and just surrender and serve Krishna. And I had no idea what that meant, you know. I had never been to a temple. And I thought, now when I go to Sydney, I'm going to have to move into this temple with these people. I didn't know what that meant, but that was it. I just thought, well, if I'm going to be honest, now I've found out the answer to what I was looking for. If I'm going to be honest, I have to act on this now. It wasn't just a mental exercise, but now I actually have to live by it if I accept that it's true. So that was it. I just decided on the spot, when I get to Sydney, find the temple and join. And I did. But that was Prabhupada. See, everybody else, you know, meditating on the apple, you know, throw the book away, be your own guru. You know, got it. You know, if you think he exists, he does. If you think he doesn't, he doesn't. You know, all this bogus stuff was around. Prabhupada was the one person who told us the facts. Yeah, not speculation. God is a person. You know, his name is Krishna. You have to surrender to him. That was it. So, you know, not everybody's looking for that, unfortunately. You know, they're not looking to come to the point of realizing really what's going on and who they really are. They prefer to entertain their illusions. And there are so many illusionists out there who are claiming to be gurus and guides and, you know, spiritual masters. So you know. But Prabhupada was the one person who was actually honestly giving us the truth. And then it was up to us, you know, you either accept it or you don't. So, you know, anyway, that's the BTG. That was how I came to Krishna consciousness. All right, sorry for boring you all. It's getting late, we better stop there. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.